Thank you for listening to this message from the pulpit of Coon Rapids Baptist Church in the suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
You knock at the door, you enter into a conversation with a person, you begin to tell this person about Jesus Christ, and this person you're talking to is interested. They're listening with open ears, open eyes. You can tell it from their attention. You can tell that their heart is opened. The last person you talked to was totally different. The last person that you talked to basically told you to get lost, told you to get out of there. What's the difference? You scratch your head in bewilderment a little bit, wondering why this person is interested when the last guy wasn't interested at all. You wonder what's going on. You wonder what the difference is. Many different things come into play in regards to why one person is interested and the other person isn't. But certainly one thing is the preparation of the soil. The soil being their heart, as Jesus talks about, I believe in Matthew chapter 13, as he gives the parable of the soil of our hearts and the seed sown on the different types of soils. Some people's hearts are open and receptive, and they've been prepared to listen to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I believe that Ecclesiastes, if you'll turn in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes, I believe that the message of Ecclesiastes gives us at least one way in which that happens, that their soil of their heart is prepared to hear the gospel that you begin to tell them. I believe that Solomon's powerful message in Ecclesiastes tells how God has designed for this fallen, ruined, empty, sin-cursed world to actually point people to himself. This horrible world is actually speaking to people. It is actually communicating a message to them. And many times as people go through this messed up, twisted, sin-cursed world, they miss the message. Other people, though, they hear it loud and clear, the message that God is trying to say to them through the vanities and the emptiness of life. From the end of the Civil War, at least up through the Great Depression and beyond, I'm sure, America experienced a great amount of people traveling the country in search of a better life. Many of them would hop trains and try to use that as their mode of transportation to get across. They were doing anything that they could to survive during some economically difficult times. These people were called the hobos. And to help each other out, they developed a system of symbols that they could mark with coal or with chalk, and these different symbols that they could etch on a piece of cardboard or on a fence post or on a light pole or whatever it was, as they had different things in the cities and in the neighborhoods. They could etch out these things on them that would give indication of whether these people would be hostile or whether they would be welcoming or whether they would have the means to provide for one. Other people would look at these things and maybe not have a clue what this circle or these squiggly marks or whatever they were etched in this fence post would mean. But to a hobo, it was a message. They could understand what was being said. That symbol was something that was speaking to them and communicating to them. And my friend, I want you to understand that Ecclesiastes tells us that our God is so good and our God is so great that even though mankind chose to take of the fruit, and they chose to sin, and as a result, the whole world was plunged into vanity, the whole world was plunged under the curse, that our God is so good and so great that he could take even that, and in that, he could cause it so that this vanity and this emptiness and this curse would be speaking and declaring and pointing people constantly back to God. If people will just have ears to hear what he is saying. The vanities of life, our God has infiltrated, and he has put in them the very thing that is speaking to the hearts of people, pointing them to Jesus Christ. And today what I purpose to do is to review the book of Ecclesiastes. I want you to be reminded of some of the basic foundational truths of Ecclesiastes. But I'm going to review it from an entirely different perspective than what we've really looked at in the entirety of our series of Ecclesiastes. I trust that you've learned some things in Ecclesiastes. I trust that God has burned some things deep on your soul. And as you walk away from it, that there'd be a sensation that God has touched my heart with this book, and I want to share it with somebody else. And so as I'm reviewing Ecclesiastes here today, I'm going to do so from a different perspective because I want to equip you and encourage you and challenge you to use the truth of Ecclesiastes in evangelism, in witnessing to other people. God is working. God is speaking to people through the hardships of life, preparing the soil of their heart for you to come along and share the gospel of them. And the hardships and the difficulties that are out there are devastating to them. But to many people, that will be the thing that will crack the rock, that will open the doorway for you to come in and share the gospel if we will be active witnessing. And so I want to challenge you to evangelize from Ecclesiastes. Using the vanities of life to point people to God. Father, I thank you for the truths of Ecclesiastes. I thank you that you're big enough to work all things together for good, even the vanities of life, the curse that's upon the world. Lord, we need that encouragement. But Lord, I thank you that you have set this up to point men to Christ and to make our job of evangelism so much easier. Lord, I pray that you'd help me to clearly explain these things, afresh and anew, burn them into our souls. And Lord, I pray that the Spirit of God would just put a passion in the hearts of every person in our church to be willing to go and to share with people what needs to be done for them to enjoy a meaningful life. So, Spirit of God, we're praying that you would do this work in Jesus' name. Amen. My normal method of preaching, generally by and large, is to give you a point and to teach you that point from the scriptures, maybe give you some application and an illustration, and then go on to the second point, teach you the point, give you some application, illustrate it, and then go on to the next one. This message is going to be different in that I'm going to give you all the points, then all the illustration, and then all the application at the end. So don't fall asleep on me at the beginning simply because I'm giving you all the points in a sense. At the beginning, all the facts, all the Bible, all the information at the beginning. I want to challenge you here with 4 points from Ecclesiastes. And number one, I want to unveil the vanities of life. Here we're going to review through a little bit of Ecclesiastes and remind ourselves what this book has to say. In our scripture reading time this morning, we've spent a good deal of time reading some of the big points. But we're going to go back to chapter number one and notice some of these. Many times a Bible writer will try to make his point by repeating key phrases, key concepts, key words. And I want you to see 8 key concepts here that we've noticed throughout Ecclesiastes that tell you the theme of Ecclesiastes. The first one is found here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The first concept is the concept of vanity. It's used 38 times in 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes. He wants you to see that this is a major point. He starts his book with it here. He ends his book in chapter 12 and verse number 8 with this same point. The word vanity comes from this idea of a vapor or of a breath of air. And sometimes as we think of that vapor or breath of air, we can see that it's short. It appears for a little time and then vanishes away and it's gone. Sometimes with that, we think of the vapor and you try to reach out and grab it and there's nothing that you can reach hold of. There's nothing that you can get a hold of. And so at times it seems so real, but it's empty. It's meaningless. It's vanity. Sometimes with that goes the idea of mystery. Sometimes with that idea then goes the frustrations of vanity and that things are so short and life is so brief and it's over and it's done. All of this is wrapped up there. And here is this wisest man to have ever lived, King Solomon. And he uses a word that describes to people how life is so short, how life is so empty, how life is just a vapor, how life is so mysterious, and life is so frustrating here. In fact, he describes it in verse number 2 as the vanity of vanities. Like we use the concept holy of holies. This is the greatest of all vanities, the worst of all vanities, the greatest emptiness. He uses in verse number 2 as well the word all. All is vanity. And I want to tell you this morning that vanity comes on all shapes and all sizes to all people. It hits people from all walks of life. Vanity is a key word. We come to verse number 3 where it says, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? The second word is the word profit. It's used 10 times. It's very much a word that is used in the business sector today. We talk about profits. We talk about you have money coming in through sales. You pay all of your bills and the money left over is profit.
This word means the same thing. It's the leftovers. It refers to the advantage of life. You've worked hard. What's the advantage of life? What's the profit to it? And he looks and he scratches his head and he's pulling out his hair in frustration and he says, what's the profit? What good is life? Third term he uses in chapter 1 verse 13, if you'll go over to that, and he says, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. Third term I want you to notice is the word exercised. It's a major expression that he gives here. It's an interesting play on words that he makes, because the word travail is the same spelling as the word exercised. But I believe Solomon is using that deliberate repetition of a key word, like we might say Job and Job, but to make a point. God has given man this sore travail to exercise them. And the word exercise means to humiliate them. It means to humble them. It means to bring them to their knees. It means to bring them to the end of themselves. And he uses this word a couple times throughout Ecclesiastes. God is giving men this sore business, this busyness of life to bring them to the point of bringing them to their knees, to humiliate them and to help them to see they're going down the wrong path, to help them to see that there's somebody greater than themselves and that they should humble themselves in the sight of God. We saw at the end of the book in chapter 12 and verse number 11 that he gives us Ecclesiastes as goads to prod us and to point us in that direction and say, no, you're going in the wrong direction. You should be going towards God. The term exercised is an important word. You look at verse number 14, we'll see another one. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. The phrase vexation of spirit means to be striving after the wind, to be chasing after the wind, to go up there and try to go after it, and you, again, it's like the vapor, and you chase after it, try to grab a hold of it, and it's empty. It's like we've said over and over, it's like herding cats. It's emptiness. And the vexation of spirit describes the frustration that comes as you try to grab hold of these things. This is a term, a phrase that's used 10 times throughout the book, and it's a key part of what he's trying to communicate. Verse number 14 also says this, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. There's our fifth concept. Under the sun is used 29 times in Ecclesiastes in 12 chapters. Describes life on this planet, life under our sun, this life, this existence, life on this ball of dirt. It's temporal. It's earthy, it's worldly, it's short. And it says all of life under the sun is meaningless. And what he is saying is a couple things. First of all, that if you're living under the sun, you're going to experience it. It's going to apply to everybody. This is something that's going to hit every person. It's going to hit your neighbor someday. It's going to hit your family member. It's going to hit your friends. It's going to hit your relatives. It's going to hit your boss. It's going to hit people under you, beside you, around you. It's going to hit everybody who's under the sun. It implies that, but it also implies this, that there's meaning above the sun. That there's meaning somewhere else. Meaning is not found just on this ball of dirt. It's above the sun, in the Son, Jesus Christ. A sixth concept that we come to in chapter number 2 and verse number 15. Chapter 2 and verse number 15, if you'll briefly turn there, we'll notice it says, then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then the more wise? Then I said in my heart, that this also is vanity, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than of the fool forever, seeing that which now is forgotten, which is in the days to come, shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man as the fool? Number 6, death. He talks about death over and over, and he says, listen, the fool, I get that you shouldn't live like a fool, that's fine. So I'm going to live like a wise man. And when all is said and done, if I live like a wise man, I'm going to die too. And if all I live for is the wisdom of this world, what am I any different than the foolish person? In fact, at the end of chapter number 3, he basically says, listen, when you kind of look at it, just from man's point of view, animals die and they get buried, humans die and they get buried, and if all there is life on this planet, what's the point? Who cares about it? He tells us in chapter 9, death is unavoidable. It's going to come to you. A life is unrepeatable. Once you die, you can't come back. Circumstances, you can't plan and figure out circumstances. You don't know when death's going to come knocking at your door. Death is something that haunts him over and over, so that by the time he gets to chapter number 12, he tells you this: remember thy creator in the days of your youth, because the day is going to come when you're going to get older and you're going to die and it's going to be over. Death is a major player in this book. Death is a major contributor, and people are impacted by death. People are constantly, our society wants to dumb it down. Our society wants to dull the pain all that they can, but death stares people in the face. And God is working there. Seventh concept that we see, and let's jump just to chapter 12. So many of these are repeated all through the middle that I'm not going to take the time and don't have the time to point you to all of them, but a seventh concept is that of judgment. 12:14 says, "For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil." In the book of Ecclesiastes, he never gives you a specific law to follow. It's not a book written just to the Jewish people alone and that's going to outline the Mosaic law. But he is going to talk about the fact that mankind know in their hearts that there is a right and there is a wrong. Romans chapter 2 and verse number 15 validates that. People have in their conscience an understanding of right and wrong. Their definitions might be different, but the fact that they have a right and a wrong in their heart shows that there is a God. And they believe that people are wronging them. They believe people have offended them. People do things against them. But in their hearts, they know that someday that should be made right. And yet they go down through the course of life, and those things aren't made right. And people mistreat them, and they get by with it all of their lives. And they've been offended and hurt all of their lives. And they go to the grave with these hurts. And they go to the grave with getting by with their sins. And in people's hearts, there is an inbred, innate desire and a sensation that there has to be a right and wrong, and there has to be a day of judgment someday. And if there is no day of judgment, then life has no meaning. I can shoot you, I can rob from you, I can hurt you, I can do whatever I want if there is no day of judgment. But there is a day of judgment, and men know it in their hearts, and it points them to God, which is the eighth truth that we have in Ecclesiastes, and that is the fear of God. The whole point, verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter, fear God and keep His commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. This is all there is to life, friends. God put you here not to live for yourself, not to live for your bank account, not to just live for your own agenda. God put you on this planet for Him. Your whole purpose in life is to fear God and do what He wants you to do in your life. Get excited about serving God with your life. And all the way through Ecclesiastes, He's been hinting at it. It's all about God. And you can go after this pleasure. It's not going to satisfy. God's the only one that's going to give you pleasure. And you can go through this thing about time. And time can be so frustrating. Why? Because God's in control of time. And you can go through pain. And pain in life can frustrate you and make you mad. But really, it's supposed to be driving you to God. He's the only way that you're going to be able to get through the pains and the hardships of life. And you can try to live fully. And you can try to live joyfully. And you can try to live all these different ways of life. But ultimately, you got to live godly. And all the way along, all the way through here, He's pointing you, fear God. It's all about God. It's all about treating God the way God ought to be treated. And those are the key concepts of Ecclesiastes. Those are the key words that He's trying to tell us over and over again. They give us the message. They give us what the book is talking about. And with that, let's move, second of all, just by way of review of Ecclesiastes, to the layout of the text, to a quick outline. Chapters 1 and 2 give us the story of pleasure. The first point that people often consider when they look at Ecclesiastes is the point of pleasure. Solomon is the wisest man to ever live. Therefore, he's incredibly, massively wealthy. We read in chapter 2 and verse number 1, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. He tries the pleasure of wisdom at the end of chapter 1. He tries foolish pleasures, godless pleasures at the beginning of chapter 2. Then he gets a little later into chapter 2. He tries some other wise pleasures, such as building and erecting all sorts of wonderful things that are good things, but are still pleasures in this world. And he comes to the chapter 2 and verse number 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Chapters 1 and 2 tell us about pleasure, and they tell us that pleasure doesn't satisfy, but pleasure rather points people to God. And many, many are the people who have come to realize this. They're perpetually greedy. They're perpetually frustrated. Eventually, they're suicidal because nothing ever satisfies them. And they know in their heart, something should satisfy me. But the pleasures of this world don't seem to. The second section is in chapters 3, 4, and 5, and that is, we've called it different things, but especially you can call it power. Chapter 3, the very familiar poem in verse number 1 about time. And here you're going through life and there's this timing set up and things happen in a certain order and you're trying to make it happen this way and it just won't happen. It's just frustrating. And you can't figure it out. Why? Because God has the power. He's making life work a certain way according to His plan. And chapter 4 talks about how you can try to climb the ladder and gain all the power you want. And at the end of life, He gives us an awesome little story at the end of chapter number 4. You can be at the pinnacle of power and success and find it was all empty. And chapter number 5 tells us that at the end of chapter number 5, the second half there, He says, you can have all these different riches and all this different wealth, but you don't have the power to enjoy it because God can reach over there and He can just pluck out the enjoyment factor. How many NBA stars, how many athletic stars, how many movie stars have wealth unbelievable and they can't enjoy it? Because God has the power and He's reached in and He's taken away the enjoyment factor from them. And these chapters remind us of people who keep trying to find satisfaction in power and they're hitting a brick wall. They think if they can climb the ladder, the power will satisfy them. Or they've been frustrated because those people in a position of power have used their power to oppress them and squeeze down upon them. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 deal with a crucial issue. If you're going to talk about the meaning of life, and that's number 3 is pain. No work on the meaning of life would be complete without talking about hardships. And he talks about how prosperity isn't always such a great thing. You might be rich, but not have the ability to enjoy it. Prosperity isn't always good, but adversity isn't always bad. Maybe better, chapter 7, for you to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. He goes on and he talks about people being frustrated that bad things happen to such good people. And good things happen to such heinous and wicked and evil and immoral people. And it's frustrating. Why does it happen? This world is so crooked. It's so bent out of shape. It's so gnarled and messed up here in this world. And we come to chapter 7 and he says in verse number 13, consider the work of God. Think about this. For who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Life's crooked and twisted and messed it up. And you can't straighten it out. Verse number 14, in the day of prosperity be joyful, but in the day of adversity consider God also has set the one over against the other to the end that man should find nothing after him. You can't figure it out. If nothing bad ever happened to good people, you would just be able to figure out life perfectly. But you can't, because you're not God. And it's constantly pointing you back to God, constantly saying, I don't know. And in verses number 16 and 17, you can try to be super righteous, or you can try to be super wicked, you can try to be super wise, or you can try to be super foolish. And he says, that's not going to solve it. The only thing that's going to solve it, verse number 18, is to take hold on this and don't let it go. It's God. The answer to avoid pain in life isn't being super spiritual. You're still going to experience pain. It's not in rejecting God and being super wicked. You're still going to experience pain. The only way to make it through the hardship is to hang on to God and don't let Him go. The pains in life are trying to point you. God. It's God. It's God. And over and over and over in chapter 6, 7, and 8, he talks about pain until he comes to the fourth section in chapters 9, 10, 11, a little bit of 12, where he talks about perseverance. How are you going to make it through life? And he tells you in 9, live fully. Live each day to its fullest. He tells you in chapter 10, live wisely. Don't be foolish and walk out on God. No, live wisely and walk with God. He tells you at the beginning of chapter 11 to live boldly. You know, go out there and take a risk, take a venture here. You don't know, God may work over here, or He may work over here, or He may work in both places and just bless you and help you to do well in life. Live boldly. He tells you at the end of verse number, or chapter 11, live joyfully. Verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Live joyfully. Hey, enjoy life. But what he wants to get your attention to is he tells you all these different things is chapter 12, verse 1, live godly. Remember now your Creator. You can live all these different things. Have fun in life. Live each day to its fullest and all of that. But it's nothing if you don't live godly. And once again, one of the key sections of Ecclesiastes points people to God. Points people to God. Points people to God. You see, the whole message of Ecclesiastes is a message that is intended to point people, Christians and unsaved people, constantly back to God, constantly to Him. And you know what? Jesus Christ did this. As we think about scriptures that support this truth, Jesus Christ talked about thirst sometimes. In John chapter 7, in verse number 37, there they're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. Nowadays, they read, many of the Jews will read Ecclesiastes at the Feast of the Tabernacles. In those days, they had some different rituals concerning water. And as they were pouring out this water, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "If any man thirst, let him come to me." And Jesus is saying, I'm the one that satisfies all of your thirst, all of your longings, all of your cravings. I will quench the thirst that you have. Same message that Ecclesiastes was saying 1,000 years earlier. Jesus in Luke chapter number 12, verses 13 through 21, has some brothers that are arguing about their inheritance. Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus says, listen, just understand that a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. And he tells the story about the farmer that is going to pull down his barns and build greater and just take his ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And he's forgotten one of the key themes of Ecclesiastes, of death and who will have all the things that are left behind. Because all the things on this earth are not all about your existence. There's more to life than that. Jesus says a man's life consists not in the abundance of things which he possesses. Jesus talked in other occasions in Luke 16 and verse number 13. No man can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon or riches or wealth. You can't serve them both. And when people finally get to the place where they quit serving riches and the pleasures and the power that Ecclesiastes talked about, then they can serve God when they quit serving the other one. Mark chapter 8 and verse number 34, what shall a man profit to gain the whole world and lose his own soul? You can gain all the stuff on this world, all the stuff on the planet, all the power, all the pleasures, but it's empty. So much so that Jesus Christ says, but there's a difference between me and others. I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. I've got the answer to life. So much so, Hebrews chapter 13 and verse number 5, he says, be without covetousness. Be content with the things that you have, because he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. And you can quit going after the things of this world. And you can quit having a constant thirst for more and power and pleasure and all of this when you finally realize, I have him. I can be content. Because he has said he'll never leave me. The satisfaction and the meaning in life is in God. It's in fearing God. And it's not in any of the things down here below. It's the message of Ecclesiastes, completely consistent with the rest of the message of Scripture. With that, I want you to, number two, understand the vanities of life. I'm going to tell you the story of three men throughout history who've understood the truths of Ecclesiastes, even though they may not have phrased them exactly that way. The first was a man by the name of Augustine. He lived 354 to 440. So a little bit older than most people in the room here. He was born into an upper class Roman family. A family that had some means. He knew much about nobility. He knew what it was like to have possessions, but he also knew what it was like to have the challenge of the sinful heart. He tells the story when he was young of stealing fruit. Enjoying stealing fruit from somebody else just because it was wrong and he enjoyed it. He was honest with himself. At the age of 19, he entered into an immoral relationship with a young woman. It was a 15-year relationship with this young woman. Sometime during this time, he made this famous prayer, God, give me chastity and continence, but not yet. He didn't want to walk away from that immorality with that young woman. In fact, the thing that brought his conversion was someone read Romans 13, verse 13. Here's what it says. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envy. And God used that to get a hold of Augustine's heart. Many years later, Augustine, around 400 AD, wrote a book called Confessions. I shouldn't call it a book. It's 13 volumes. He became a Christian. He became a mighty leader in the church, and he wrote Confessions. Confessions wasn't necessarily him confessing a creed. Confessions wasn't him confessing all of his sin and writing 13 books about it. Confessions was him confessing the greatness of his God And it's interesting what Augustine had to say as he used his own life story to point people to God, to confess how great his God is. Here's what he's very famous for saying. See if it connects with Ecclesiastes. He said this, "For thou hast formed us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee." Famous statement by Augustine. Our hearts are restless. Solomon said our hearts are empty, and we try this, and we try this, and we try this, and all along it's pointing us to God. And Augustine said this, "Yeah, I know what it's like. I know what it's like to take things that are mine. I know what it's like to try immorality. I know what it's like to live the noble life. I know what it's like to have some possessions here. And my heart was restless until I finally found rest in Christ." You see, the message of Ecclesiastes is real. We fast forward 1600 years to a man by the name of Blaise Pascal. Blaise Pascal is an interesting one to consider along this purpose. We're not talking here about guys that were necessarily preachers. Augustine came from a life of immorality and eventually became that, but Blaise Pascal was a scientist in the 1600s. He was a mathematician. He was an inventor. Blaise Pascal eventually came to general Christianity, maybe not born-again Christianity, but he came from an atheistic background to believe the tenets of God and Jesus Christ. And he began to try to use reason and logic to defend the belief in Christianity. And so he began to collect different statements that would appeal to people, different statements that would work on people's consciences. And they began to be called the pensées, P-E-N-S-E-E-S, pensées. 1,000 statements given to skeptics in the 1600s. He began to collect all these different statements. Unfortunately, he died before the book was published, and so somebody else collected them all and published this particular work. But he writes from a person who had been an atheist and came to God. He writes from the perspective of somebody who was a scientist, a mathematician, an inventor, a great thinker, began to understand God. And here's a quotation that he made. He says this, "What else does this craving, this helplessness proclaim, but that there was once in man a true happiness, of which now that remains is an empty print and an empty trace. This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him, seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are there, though none can help. Since this infinite abyss in his heart can be filled only with an infinite object." In other words, by God himself. This pensées number 425 is the source from which people got the expression that God shaped hole in your heart that only God can fill. He was the man who began to think and reason. He wrote to people in such a way to provoke their thirst. He wrote it to people who were thirsting, who were craving, constantly pointing them to God. And he says, listen, there's an emptiness in life. There's a vanity about life, and it's constantly pointing you to God. There's a God-shaped hole in your heart and life that only God can fill. In the 20th century, number three, it was C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, I don't know if you knew, was raised in a religious family. He attended the Church of Ireland, but he became an atheist at the age of 15. And for 15 years, he struggled with what he was going to believe before he finally returned to a belief in God and converted to Anglican Christianity at the age of 31. But he began to deal with one of the great themes that Ecclesiastes touches on, and that is the problem of evil. In fact, he writes a book entitled The Problem of Pain, and here's what C.S. Lewis has to say. God whispers to us in our pleasures. Isn't that what Ecclesiastes said? We look for the pleasures and God's trying to get our attention. He goes on, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to our conscience, but shouts to our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Because C.S. Lewis understood that the pains of life are things that God has designed to constantly be pointing men to God, constantly be pointing men to God over and over again. I want you to see that it's true in life. Number three, I want you to unify the vanities of life. Let's put them together. Let me make 3 points. Letter A, I want you to think about, as we've studied Ecclesiastes, the scope of the vanity here. The scope of it. Solomon said rather, all is vanity. Everything is vanity. He said this applies to everything under the sun. Every person who lives under the sun. The scope of the vanity is immense. It's huge. And listen, friend, I want to tell you this morning that I believe every single person who walks on planet Earth at some point in time in their life is going to experience vanity in this sense. They may not experience all of the vanities. They may not experience them all at the same time. They may not experience them in childhood or in their 20s or as a young family. It may not be till the end of life, but at some point in time in life, they're going to come face to face with raw vanity in their lives. The scope of the vanity is immense. It is something that touches every single person out there. Number two, the means of the vanity are pleasures, powers, and pain. One of those three things are working in people's lives, trying to get their attention, trying to point them to God again and again and again. Number three, the purpose of that vanity. That purpose of the vanity, Solomon says in 12:11, has been the cattle prod to point them to God. Constantly point them. He said it's to exercise them. It's them to bring them to their knees so they say, hey, life isn't all about me. Life must be about God. I tried and I tried and I tried and I was banging my head against a brick wall. Somebody must be in control of this that's bigger than me. I tried all I could to do what's right and they still oppressed me and they still hurt me. Somebody's got to make it right. There's got to be a God somewhere that's going to make this right somewhere. The purpose of vanity is to constantly point men to God. And in conclusion, then, I want to challenge you to use the vanities of life. I want you, now that you've understood Ecclesiastes and been reminded of its truths, how are you going to use it? First of all, number one there, be equipped. I hope that this little bit of review today has reminded you of what Ecclesiastes says. I hope that you're reminded of the three major vanities of pleasure and of pain and of power. I hope that you know that. I hope that they stick into your heart and mind. Know Ecclesiastes. Know about vanity. Know all about it. Number two, be encouraged. Trust Ecclesiastes. Sometimes as we're challenged to witness, and we witness to that person that seems so hard, we sometimes think about our culture that is going down the drain and people are more antagonistic and they're more hostile than ever to Christianity, it feels. We read in the news about reports from around the world of people harming and persecuting Christians. And we stand there and we say, this is so hard. This is so difficult. How in the world are we ever going to witness? How is anybody ever going to be interested in the gospel of Jesus Christ? And listen, I want to encourage you this morning that our God in heaven has reached down into this sin-cursed world and He's put His megaphone down in these vanities here because there are people, every single one of them, are going to experience this at some point in time in their lives. And many times we say, you know what? It's a lot easier to go witness in the ghettos. It's a lot easier to go witness in the low-income neighborhoods because they have needs and they have problems. But all those rich people, they don't have the needs and they don't have the problems and they're not interested. But let me tell you, my Bible in Ecclesiastes tells me that they will experience the vanities of life, and they may have a 3-car garage, and they may have a boat in the back, and they might have a property up north that they can enjoy in, but it's not satisfying them. It's empty, and they need somebody to knock on their door. They need somebody to pass out a tract and give it to them, and someday in the darkness of their heart, sitting in their beautiful, elaborate man cave with surround sound system and everything, and it's not satisfying, they need to pick up the tract and find, yeah, it's empty. It doesn't satisfy. And here's the answer. I don't have to be in the ghetto just to experience the vanities of life. I might be low class, middle class, upper class. But let me tell you, in this wealthy American world that has so much to us, we're going to experience the emptiness of pleasures and power and pain. And you watch your neighbors. And you pray for your friends. And you keep an eye on the people in your sphere of influence. And you be encouraged that God is working and He's preparing the hearts. And when the time is right, the vanity will enter in and God will be speaking to them. And you be encouraged. He is preparing, as He promised, a harvest that is white and ready to be harvested here. Be encouraged that God is working. Number three, be evangelistic. Use Ecclesiastes. Be prepared. The little children's song based on scripture says He heals the brokenhearted. The pains of life. And our Bible gives the only answer to the empty, meaningless life, the rat race that the Twin Cities goes through week in and week out. You have the answer. You have what people are looking for. You have what they've wasted 70 years of their life trying to search for. You have the only answers to help them through the loss of the loved one. You have the answers to their pain. You have the answers to when they've been mistreated by other people. You have the answers. And as God burns the answers into your hearts, it's not coming in and shoving religion down their face. It's not coming up into them and making them come to your church and give money to your church. It's not twisting their arm to Jesus here. It's coming up to them and saying, listen, I mean it when I say, I can offer you a meaningful life. I can tell you how to enjoy a meaningful life. And I care about you enough to tell you, yeah, pleasures aren't going to satisfy, and neither is power, and pain's going to hurt. But my God's there, and He has the answers. And He's looking for Christians who will open their mouths when their neighbor and their coworker and their relatives are going through that, because God is already speaking. He's already working in their hearts. And if we don't come along at the right time and share the gospel to them, they'll turn away from God and they'll turn to the drugs and they'll turn deeper to immorality and they'll turn to atheism and ultimately they'll turn to suicide if we're not there to give them the answers. God's working. Be encouraged and be evangelistic. Tell someone what you've learned. Speak up. Pass out tracts. Watch for those that are going through the vanity of life. Pray for those divine appointments. Evangelize from Ecclesiastes. The stillness of night when no one else is around, people can hear it. It's the voice of vanity. It speaks to every man, every woman, at some time in their lives. God has put His witness there to them. There is a God. And what they need is they need someone to come along and tell them then about Jesus Christ and lead them to Him. Have you turned to Jesus Christ for your salvation? And are you telling other people about Him and the vanities of life?
Visit us at 11164 Hanson Boulevard or online at coonrapidsbaptist.org.